I mean, what I've realized, if everyone wants to know about my hero's journey,
yes,
is that I am Paul Atreides. I rejected my destiny, which was to discuss sci-fi on this show. I said never. No, it cannot happen. And then when the time came, I embraced it. I embraced
South,
it truly.
Drank the water of life.
I drank the water of life.
Oh, wow.
And then you freaked the fuck out and your voice dropped like 7 octaves.
I drank the water of life. Bring me the juice.
Of course, we're speaking about seeing Dune 2, Return of the Dune.
Dune, we're so back.
Dune, we're so back.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham.
And I'm Alex Schwartz. Hello, you guys.
Hi.
Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. So, strap in.
Oh my God.
Because today, Critics at Large is boldly going where we have never gone before. The world of science fiction.
Woo. Pigs in space.
Pigs in space. Oh, Nomi, great reference. Oh, the Muppets. Let's keep them right with us. We're talking today about the huge sci-fi work that's out right now, the Dune movie. Dare I say its name? Dune Part 2, that has absolutely dominated at the box office this month.
You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades. My family's been fighting them for centuries. They were massacred alongside my father.
My father didn't believe in revenge.
We believe science fiction is really big in the culture right now. There's Dune, of course, but there are many, many other examples. Just to think of another one off the top of my head, there's Three Body Problem, which is a new show on Netflix, adapted from the mega, mega popular Chinese sci-fi novel by Lu Cixin.
We don't know what they are. Maybe we can't know what they are.
And it feels like every month there's a new blockbuster, bestseller, that uses sci-fi tropes. And it really seems, to me at least, that sci-fi has kind of never been more at the center of our media landscape than it is now. Mm. And I think that is in part because the world itself is feeling more and more like science fiction every day. Mm. Just to come up with a few examples.
Yeah. Please do.
Very top of my head. Artificial intelligence. You know, AI overthrowing humans is no longer just speculative. It seems actually very plausible and is a subject of serious conversation, as is forming colonies on Mars, as some people whose names may or may not come up today.
A multi-planetary future.
To do. Exactly. Mm. We've just lived through a life-altering global pandemic that certainly a few years ago would have seen the stuff of science fiction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, climate change. There it is, threatens to reshape Earth itself into a planet that's increasingly uninhabitable for human life, for all life.
Oh, my God.
Basically, science fiction feels more aligned with real life than it ever has been.
Yep.
And so that's today on Critics at Large. Is science fiction the new realism?
Mamma mia.
Critics, friends,
countrymen.
I think countrymen and women. We need to just, I think, come clean at the top.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I want to unburden myself to you and to the listeners, mm-hmm. which is just to say that dipping into the vast realm of science fiction does feel a bit like a maiden voyage because I, for one, am not the most, it will shock everyone to know that I'm not the most well-versed in this genre.
Alex, nor am I.
Yeah, I think we share this in common. When I was a kid, I really loved. For a while, I would have told you when I was a kid that my favorite book was Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles.
Oh,
1950.
Well, then what went awry on the way to adulthood?
I don't know. I encountered other forms of literature, and I kind of went off. You know, the realist novel stole my heart. I guess. You know,
same.
And so I'm really excited to get into these. The things that we're going to talk about today, because I could feel my childhood kicking in within my
guts.
Really
so can I. I had an Isaac Asimov phase.
Oh, my God, me too. That's what I was just going to say, Alex.
And then where did the phase go? I mean, we're picking it up years later, I guess.
I know.
Okay, so the three of us have just dug into the huge event in science fiction right now, and that, of course, is the new Dune movie. The first Dune movie came out in 2021, and the second one came out earlier this month. They are both directed by Denis Villeneuve. and feature an absolutely stacked cast. I mean, so when Anya cool Taylor-Joy came out of the woodwork, I was like, her too?
I know.
We have Timothée Chalamet as Paul
Atreides.
Atreides. Mm-hmm. Thank you. It was on the tip of my tongue. Oscar Isaac, Zendaya, Jason Momoa, Javier Bardem. The list goes on.
On and on.
You know, they're also in the new one.
Florence Pugh.
Well, right. So I was going to say in the new one, there's Florence Pugh, and who's the daughter of the emperor. And her father, the emperor, is Christopher Walken. And I'm sorry. I mean, I want to know what everyone thought of these movies. I could not stop laughing when Christopher Walken was on the screen. Like, I can't remember his exact lines, but it was just
very— He's like,
very,
I'll tell you why I killed your father.
Yeah. It was very like, what's going to happen to the empire?
I'm like, this again?
It was just.
But in space?
Totally. It's that. It's Christopher Walken in Space is the subtitle of Doom Part 2. Well, let's get some impressions going. I want to know what my fellow critics thought of Doom Part 2.
Okay, so I've stayed away from sci-fi like it was, you know, too hot to the touch. You know, my father was a big sci-fi fan. I'm married to a man who enjoys occasional forays into the sci-fi genre. And I just find it incredibly boring and unrelatable. And if it's not boring and unrelatable, I find it frightening in a way that I don't enjoy. So I have to say I was a little bit fearful at the prospect of watching Dune and then Dune Part 2. And then I watched the first Dune at home, because it's available for streaming.
A safe space.
And I was actually pleasantly surprised, because it seemed like it was quite arty, which I enjoyed. I was like, oh my God, this is like 3 hours of like amazing brutalist architecture and incredible scenic views and gorgeous photography.
And, so you're basically saying that Dune is also a lifestyle magazine.
Well, yes, but in a strange, interesting way.
Yeah.
So I was pleasantly surprised, and I was like, oh, maybe I like science fiction. Like, maybe this is a new tomorrow for me, a new horizon. But Part 2.
More Nomi, more Dune.
Which I went to see in the theater. Longer than Claude Lanzmann's Shoah.
Okay. All right.
Which is, as we know, the bar.
Yeah. Yes. Vincent, I'm turning to you.
No, hold on. I just want to say, hold on. Felt like it was 29 hours long. So I was like, maybe sci-fi isn't for me anymore.
Mm. Okay. So with Nomi, we got like a parabola. Why am I compelled to now try to prove my own mathiness? Nomi warmed up to sci-fi and then has been rendered cold again by Dune Part 2. Mm-hmm. Vincent.
I would say something like the opposite. Well, not the opposite, because Dune 1 didn't like repel me. I liked Dune 1. I thought it was beautiful, to your point about just the visuals. Mm-hmm. And Villeneuve has talked in multiple venues about how he's like, you know, I really don't care about dialogue. I kind of think silent film was the best era of film. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just want to create beautiful visuals. And he also just has like amazing sound. There's like this ongoing, like every time something cool happens, it's like, wow, wow. You know, it's just like this, like sort of like, somebody's going to shred on the guitar for a while Timothée rides this worm or whatever.
Rides much like Jim Morrison, he rides the snake.
Exactly right. Part 2, I thought was even better. Part of, to me, what is so difficult, I guess, like the sort of the tightrope of science fiction is its relationship to backstory and especially lore. Mm. Because it has to spend so much time setting things up, explaining to you how the world works. What are the sort of, especially in Dune, like the political and interplanetary stakes, this great house, this, you know, who's the emperor, all this stuff.
I want to do something that's sort of equivalent of like picking up the mic at karaoke. I want to try to give a summary of Dune. I want to make myself vulnerable.
Oh yeah,
to
please
everyone.
Do. I don't remember a single name of anything, so please, you'll have to do it.
All right, because if there are others out there like us, and surely there are, who have not yet, you know, entered the Duneverse, then
I want
you to know that we've got you. All right, so here's what's going on. It is a year circa 10,000. There is a desert planet called, Arrakis.
Arrakis.
And the desert planet Arrakis has a very special substance, and that substance is called spice. And spice is kind of like the oil of this universe, I'm gathering. And the emperor has sent different houses to Arrakis to kind of do the colonial administration, to do the spice mining that will service the empire. Mm-hmm. So for many years, I gather, the House of Harkonnen was ruling Arrakis. The mm-hmm. House of Harkonnen, they all look like giant Nazi slugs. That's kind of their aesthetic.
That's it.
They're big, they're bald, they're white to the point of like kind of being in grayscale. Yeah. And
they're also, there's like an S&M element to their dress too.
Yeah, totally. Like,
yes. And the Baron is very, played by Stellan Skarsgård, the leader of the House of Harkonnen, is very Colonel Kurtz, like,
exactly.
Consciously.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yes. So at the beginning of Dune Part One, mm-hmm. they are relieved of their duties, and the House of Atreides is brought in as the new rulers of Arrakis. We soon discover it's because the emperor wants to create conflict between Harkonnen and Atreides and decimate the House of Atreides, which he does in a battle in the first movie. Meanwhile, Paul Atreides, son of Leto Atreides and his concubine, Lady Jessica, who's a member of this order called the Bene
Gesserit.
These spooky women who are kind of nun-like and have various magical powers that they've cultivated over generations. Paul has some of these magical powers. He's able to compel people to do things
Pass me the water!
Oh, my God, by using exactly that voice. And as these movies progress, you know, Paul, two things are going on. One, it's a classic hero's journey, mm-hmm. where Paul is kind of stepping into his own. And part two is that the planet of Arrakis has an indigenous people who are known as the Fremen. And the Fremen has a prophecy that an outsider will come among them and kind of be their messiah and usher in the day when they are no longer the subjugated peoples of whoever has come to Arrakis to rule them, when in fact they will be free and Arrakis will be restored to a state of paradise. Mm-hmm. And there are various signs that suggests that Paul may be this outsider.
It cools the body and recycles the water lost to sweat. Your body's movements provide the power. Inside the mask, you'll find a tube to allow you to drink the recycled water. Hmm. In good working order, your suit won't lose more than a thimbleful of water a day.
Most impressive.
Let's have a look at you, lad. You've worn a steel suit before?
No, this is my first time.
Your desert boots are fitted slip fashion at the ankles. Who taught you to do that?
Seemed the right way.
So Dune Part 2 sees Paul adopting many of the Fremen ways. He can speak their language. He quickly understands many things about their desert survival culture. So that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there is much conflict throughout the empire.
I thought there were some awesome fights. The fight toward the end, I love battle scene. This is why, like, I've never liked it.
So,
yeah, I like filmed combat, right? Mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm. So spoiler alert. But if you watched this movie and didn't think that Timothée was going to fight Austin Butler, I don't know what to tell you. They fight, and it is fucking sick.
May thy knife chip and shatter. May thy knife chip and shatter.
I mean, that I like, because it was one-on-one. And they're both, I was rooting for Austin Butler to kill Timothy, but
he's like, Fid Rotha. Yeah. I pledge myself.
Yeah, because I was really into him.
What if Nomi was suddenly a Harkonnen?
Yeah. He comes in with those shaved eyebrows like Julia Fox or something. You know, he's like wearing that like vinyl suit.
Yeah.
Okay,
he was
guys,
awesome. Anyway, sorry.
So we have seen both Dunes, but we must admit we remain novices in this realm. And so to help us, to guide us, as it were, on our hero's journey, we have called in a Yoda, as it were, question mark.
Oh.
Could that be an appropriate usage?
Right.
We needed someone
yeah.
who knows this world and who could help us navigate it. And so we decided to ask our friend and colleague, Josh Rothman, ideas editor at The New Yorker, to come in here and school us. Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me? How's it going?
It's been such a long time, man.
Hold on. I have to turn on
self-view or whatever. I can't even... Oh, there we go. Okay, there, now I can see.
Okay, well, Josh, I think it's fair to say that you are not only a sci-fi fan, but very knowledgeable about the genre and the state of sci-fi. So was there a book or a movie that got you at a young age that captured your imagination and brought you into this world?
Well, when I was like a little kid, I was like a Star Trek, Star Wars nerd. My family is all scientists, and my dad is a super science fiction nerd. Mm. And like I was at a family wedding a couple years ago, and with a bunch of us all around the table, and everyone spontaneously burst into the introductory monologue from Star Trek, you know, like space, the final frontier.
Yeah.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange...
But I think probably when I read 2001, Arthur C. Clarke novel, which I must have read when I was like 9. I mean, I couldn't have been a big grown-up at that time. So I read all that stuff, like Dune and all that stuff, when I was like in high school. And I loved all those books a lot. And then when I came to The New Yorker, I like seized at the opportunity to profile a bunch of science fiction writers.
I would love to know what you thought about the Dune adaptations. How did they, you know, stack up to you? And is there a specific moment in the Dune adaptation that you thought got the books really right or really wrong?
Yeah. So the thing I didn't love about the new Dune movies is they just felt sort of boring to me. Dune is actually really bizarre. Like, the books are really weird. And I don't know if you guys have ever... I'm guessing no, but, you know, David Lynch made a version of Dune very famously in the 80s.
Right.
And it is like 10 times more incomprehensible than this Dune.
Well, I have seen Kyle MacLachlan ride the worm. And if you guys like, you know, electric guitar and worm riding in the same shot, may I recommend that YouTube clip to all of you?
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So it's more incomprehensible. It's more...
It's more incomprehensible and bizarre and weirder, obviously, than this Dune. And I really like that Dune, the Lynch Dune. And I kind of felt like this Dune is insufficiently weird. And the books are really weird.
Hmm. Okay.
And like, one thing I'd say is the spice in Dune is a drug.
Yes.
That gives you basically kind of druggy hallucinatory powers, like something from a, I think the Dune novel is from 1965. So the whole thing is incredibly druggy and psychedelic. But like, the core of the idea of Dune, I think the reason people really like it is because it's a different idea of the future that's interesting to think about, because it's not a techie future. Like, if when you read the Dune novel, if you go to the back of it, there's like one of those chronologies. And it's like, to your point, Vincent, about lore, it's like a totally out of control chronology that's like itself really long. But it explains that in the prehistory of Dune, I guess it's like AI got out of control. And so now there can be no computers, and it has to be a world where...
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's kind of like everything that you use to achieve competitive advantage comes from people's minds. Like, no one's like a coder,
right,
in Dune. Like, everything is like a it's kind of like related to the world of meditation and like martial arts and like microdosing.
Yeah, it's kind of new agey.
In a minute, the case for science fiction as realism. Critics at Large will be right back.
Who are the risk takers that help reinvent and reimagine the kinds of stories we see on TV? We Disrupt This Broadcast, a brand new podcast from the Peabody Awards and the Center for Media and Social Impact, talks to creators of TV shows like Abbott Elementary, Watchmen, Black Mirror, and Better Things to explore how the most compelling shows and the creative powers behind them are upending the status quo. Listen to We Disrupt This Broadcast now, available where you get your podcasts.
One thing I did notice about the movies is that the future world they depict really feels like a version also of the past. There is a feudal system, the houses, there's also religion plays an absolutely enormous role in things. And I think religion is something that people are often used to associating with anti-science. Like, in the world of science, religion will cease to play a role. And actually, religion is huge here. So what I want to ask you is, how connected is good science fiction to the real world? Like, are there some examples of how science fiction has evolved alongside reality? Dune seems to be a classic 60s book from what you're saying.
Yeah, Dune is like super 60s. Yeah, I think if there's like a spectrum of sci-fi where some science fiction is very connected to realism and some science fiction is relatively unconnected to realism and it pulls more from other literary traditions like the romance or the epic or something like that. Like Dune is much more on that second end of the spectrum. It's like it's closer to, you know, an epic or to a, you know, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, like romance type of thing than it is to a kind of novel. But a lot of science fiction comes out of the realist novel tradition as a genre. Like literary science fiction is connected to the 19th century novel and came out, you know, out of the same roots of trying to describe reality. So like a couple of years ago, I profiled this novelist named Kim Stanley Robinson, who's a science fiction writer who writes mainly about climate change.
Readers, you have to get into this, by the way. You have to read this profile. It is lovely.
Yeah, it's really good. I can't, Josh, just to give listeners a taste, Josh went on a hike in the Sierras with Robinson, right, Josh, for like three days, I believe. And reading this profile, I was like, I can't believe you did this.
it's so scary.
Yeah.
It was great.
It sounds so difficult.
It was more mountaineering than I'm used to. But he has this way of talking. He says like science fiction does two things at the same time in different proportions. So one thing it does is it imagines a future and you judge that and you relate to it. And you ask yourself, like, is this plausible and is it interesting? And did it bring my attention to aspects of the kind of future possibilities that maybe I didn't think about? So one thing it does is it looks to the future and imagines these scenarios. The other thing it does is it asks you to compare this future scenario and to think of it as an allegory or a metaphor for our present situation. Mm-hmm. So like to give you a really obvious example is like The Matrix, which is, I think it's like a lot of people's favorite science fiction thing. I think it's probably the science fiction thing that's been the biggest kind of event during my lifetime.
For sure, yeah.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends, you wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
So The Matrix envisions this possible future, you know, someday the machines will take over and, you know, we'll be essentially at war with them in some way. That's scary. And you can plug yourself into a computer and live in a simulation.
Right.
So on the one hand, it does that. And on the other hand, it obviously asks you to think about whether today, how much of that future scenario actually just describes today. So,
right.
You know, like to what degree has our civilization already been totally taken over by machines or computers? And how much are we okay with this? And how much are we angry about it? That's like kind of what The Matrix is about. It's like, right. Do you want to take which pill do you want to take? And like some science fiction is more about the future scenario and it's more purely just kind of fun, imagination, speculation. And then some science fiction is even more about sort of the present and eventually, on that end of things, things merge into just a novel it's science fiction, but it's actually just about like our world. You know, if you think about like that Steven Soderbergh movie Contagion.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Arguably,
yes.
It's science fiction, but it's just really a description of the world.
They see if they get any better.
So at this point, I think we have to believe this is respiratory. Maybe fomites, too.
What's that, fomites?
It refers to transmission from surfaces. The average person touches their face 2,000 or 3,000 times a day.
2,000 or 3,000 times a day?
3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, elevator buttons, and each other. Those things become fomites.
Is this something we want to release to the press, respiratory and fomites?
And how's the public going to react to that?
Hard to say. plastic shark in a movie will keep people from getting in the ocean, but a warning on the side of a pack of cigarettes.
We're going to need to walk the government through this before we start to freak everybody out. I mean, we can't even tell people right now what they should be afraid of. We tried that with swine flu, and all we did was get healthy people scared. It's the biggest shopping weekend of the year.
I think we need to consider closing the schools down.
And who stays home with the kids? People that work at stores, government workers, people that work at hospitals. When will we know what this is?
Well,
the world that came
right,
to be.
It's a description, but it was only a description 10 years after the fact. You know, Contagion came out, I think, in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the idea is, like, in 2011, there already had been little epidemics of various kinds. And of course, there had been, you know, the Spanish flu. So there's a kind of way where, like, the future seems really futuristic. But if you look around for it in the present, you'll find a version of it somewhere. There's a famous William Gibson remark, which is that the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed.
Hmm.
And so there's always like an idea that science fiction is actually just, sometimes it's hyper-speculative, but a lot of times it's just describing what some people already think is happening somewhere in the world. So it's a form of realism in that sense. Like, I just read this novel by a novelist named Naomi Alderman. And it's a really good book called The Future. Mm-hmm. It's like a totally delightful literary science fiction novel that its main characters are basically not thinly fictionalized, but they're fictionalized versions of Elon Musk, Tim Cook, and Jeff Bezos.
Wow.
And it all revolves around the underground bunkers that these fictionalized tech moguls have prepared for themselves, and question of when you go into the bunker. it's like you don't want to wait too long, but you don't want to spend an unnecessary amount of time in the bunker.
Right.
So it's like a good question. And that book has like elements of science fiction, but it feels like it's written totally. It's speculating about stuff that it's very natural to speculate about today,
right now.
Like you know, and the New Yorker, we ran a great piece a couple of years ago about tech zillionaires and their underground bunkers. Mm. So it's actually a science fiction scenario that's totally real.
Do you think that we're at a point where science fiction has become more real than realism? Like, how accurate are, I mean, I'm not asking you to evaluate, I was about to say, how accurate are some of these predictions? Like, what we can all kind of see for ourselves. But are we plausibly caught up?
Well, I'll tell you how I feel about it, just personally, right? The way I feel about it is, the reason I'm a science fiction reader now, you know, totally separate from when I was a kid, when it was just my kind of inherited preference from my dad. Mm-hmm. But why I, as a 44-year-old literary reader, still read a lot of science fiction. Well, it's basically because I find the future, the actual future that we're all moving into, to be quite scary and sort of unthinkable. Like, it's very hard to think about what this future world we're going to live in is going to be like, or like what kind of future world my kids will live in.
Yeah.
And science fiction is the literary genre that addresses this problem. It helps make the future into something you can imagine. And you get used to thinking about the future. You start to think about, you know, like a good example would be in climate change science fiction. There's different climate change science fiction writers, and they have different temperaments. And you can ask yourself, do I think that Kim Stanley Robinson's idea of the future feels plausible to me? It's an optimistic view of the climate situation? Or do you believe like the Neal Stephenson view of the future, which is a darker view of the climate future? And you can think about it. And in that sense, I think that's why I don't think we've like caught up where science fiction sort of accurately describes how crazy the future is. I think it's sort of the opposite. It's like as the future gets more hard to picture, science fiction becomes more and more appealing because it's giving you some traction on this otherwise really slippery kind of mysterious place.
Yeah.
So my last question for you is, why is science fiction so popular now?
So I think there's we are living in a more futuristic time. I think it's actually true that like the way we live now with our little pocket computers basically makes you more willing to read about science fiction stuff. Because I think just there's some way where our lives now are so much more technologically mediated than they were a little while ago that just the central premise of science fiction, which is that this technology matters, that's something we all accept, like, just totally. At this point.
Yeah.
Another answer to this is you get the feeling sometimes that a lot of the people who are in charge of the technological future grew up on sci-fi. And they want to make it real. Yeah, they want to make it real. So one other reason we're all into it is because the really powerful people are really into it.
That's very true, Josh. I was reading an interview from when the Dune Part 1 came out in which Grimes, sometime partner to Elon Musk, was comparing what her son X will experience in life to what Paul Atreides himself experienced in Dune. So I think that there is a lot of comparisons being made between our overlords and the science fiction that they grew up in.
Honestly, I mean, I love Grimes. That's a good way to think about Dune.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the life of a present day 5-year-old going to be like? It probably is going to involve like mind altering, crazy tech experiences in a resource starved world of like geopolitical competitions. So I guess that's a pretty good, you know.
Yeah. And it's going to be like, pass me the juice. And then everything
else. He's probably already that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Josh Rothman, the time has come in our hero's journey when we must ride the worm. Farewell, for we are headed to the south. Wish us luck on our journey through the giant sandstorm. Good luck in the north, staving off the Harkonnen hordes. Adieu.
Wow.
Adieu. Wow. Great job. Amazing. Yeah, it's great to see you guys.
Awesome.
So good to
see
you.
Yes. Okay. More soon.
Bye,
bye guys.
In a minute, as science fiction becomes more and more like reality, do we have a civic obligation to engage with it?
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
I am developing, over the course of our conversation today, a little bit of a theory.
Okay. Ooh.
Josh Rothman is making me think about how the attempt in science fiction to confront the future puts the reader in a kind of civic position.
Hmm.
And where we all are faced now in the present, mm-hmm, with an obligation to think about the future, maybe more than ever before. Maybe not. I think that obligation has been with us for some time. But I'm certainly feeling it more than ever before.
Sure.
I think what Josh said about thinking about the next generation and what and the world they're going to face, I mean, that's become a trope just of the way we talk about climate change, you
that's
know?
Right.
Sure.
Maybe you won't
AI
live.
And,
exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe you won't live to see the utter collapse of society in the present, but think about the children.
Your
think
children,
about your
grandchildren.
Children, your grandchildren, et cetera. You know, I wonder if that idea about civics, fundamentally civics,
mm-hmm,
that we need to look to the future and make a better planet and or society or a combination of all of these things,
mm-hmm,
is some of what is reanimating the interest in science fiction.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it seems to me that the obligations are twofold, that we, the three of us in this room, have an obligation to consider science fiction really seriously and not just to be stuck in our comfort zone of realism, because it's realism in that it will become our realism,
mm-hmm,
or could. And then also that science fiction writers, you know, have an obligation to think about where they're taking us. I mean, I don't want to sound preachy in any way.
No, but yeah. I think this is totally true. And I think it really explains to me in kind of a broader, more incisive way, my knee-jerk fear and escape from science fiction as a child, then as a young person, and now as an older person. As reality has become more and more frightening, I think my kind of like fight with myself to continue to read the news, to continue to be informed, you know, et cetera, et cetera, I can kind of totally see the parallels of that with my attitude as a young person towards science fiction. It's like, don't scare me. I don't want to think about what happens when I go in the space rocket, you know? And I'm taken away from all that is safe and familiar, you know, which is now what I feel when I read the real life news as an adult. And so I think you're totally right. And it is a kind of like question of responsibility. And it's also just so interesting because I think vernacularly we're used to thinking about science fiction as escape, right? As
exactly.
A legend, as, mm-hmm. as, you know, as lore. But what we've kind of been discussing here is that, in fact, it's becoming quite the opposite.
You know, there is a pessimistic counterpoint to all that, which right. is the way that it does seem to me that sometimes science fiction can leak into reality in a way that actually is truly pernicious, mm-hmm. that people can confuse the tropes and the metaphors of science fiction and bring them into the real world, and the real world then increasingly spins out. And I think actually The Matrix, which Josh was talking mm-hmm. about, is the classic example. People talking about getting red-pilled.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the far right having this idea of being red-pilled, finally waking up to a political reality that's been covered up for them. Like, that metaphor has bled into reality to the point that actually confuses reality all over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. the idea, you know, crazy conspiracies, someone like QAnon speaking out from things that truly seem fictional and are fictional and
right.
are absurd, then are remade into plausibility. So some blurring of reality is going on that isn't so good at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what he said I thought was really interesting about the people who are on some level, have the power to bring things into reality, who can dictate to us our future, you know, the tech founder figure, right? Elon Musk, are people who have read a lot of this literature and are bringing it to bear in our real lives. And so to your idea about civics, it does seem more than ever necessary to sort of, on some level, anticipate the sort of outgrowth of this ethos to say, like, so what exactly does and why do they want to do this? And if it's in a novel somewhere, maybe I ought to read that novel. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we're always worried about, I think, the sort of the logic of the conspiracy theorist, and on some level maybe informed by science fiction, is that there is a playbook out there.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that there is a reality behind that, you know, if that is true, this brings the responsibilities, like our literary responsibilities, as you say, the civics of reading, of participating in a genre or whatever. I think that makes that much more of a sort of urgent.
Yeah, it ups the ante a lot if we're asking writers and thinkers to try to point the way forward using right. science as a metaphor. And this makes me want to ask you guys, did you watch any of the new Netflix show, The Three Body Problem?
I watched the first couple of episodes.
Yeah, I watched the first episode.
So this is the show that's just come out on Netflix, made by Benioff and Weiss, who were behind Game of Thrones, and Alexander Wu. And it's adapted from the best-selling novel The Three Body Problem by Liu Cixin, translated from Chinese and English by Ken Liu. And the very brief synopsis is that The Three Body Problem deals with contact between aliens and humans, that humans years ago during the Cultural Revolution in China developed a system to contact aliens, and now the aliens are contacting us back in ways that are not so great because right. there is about to be a real War of the Worlds scenario upon our hands. The book is a huge phenomenon. It's a big bestseller. I've heard people speak reverentially about it. And I was really interested to read in our colleague Jiayang Fan's profile of the writer, Liu Cixin, that it turns out that a few years ago, China's aerospace agency asked Liu, whose first career was as a computer engineer in the hydropower industry, to talk to people about the ways that sci-fi thinking could be used to produce science itself. Yeah. So that kind of harnessing of the literary imagination and the scientific imagination is really fascinating. Yeah. I mean, for me, and I've seen only a bit of the show, but I will just say the thing I like most about the show, and this is just my biases, but it is the historical fiction depiction of Maoist China.
Yes, it was very interesting.
Which
I found that interesting
feels,
too.
Which
though,
was so good. It starts with a horrific scene.
A horrific scene of a
struggle session.
Yes.
Yeah.
The struggle session, just to, you know, briefly idea, in which people were humiliated in Maoist China in front of a crowd.
Bloodthirsty crowds.
Right.
And eventually they would either say things that they knew to be lies and escape the situation, or they would tell the truth and be killed.
That, even though it's history, did seem kind of science fiction-y to me in
That's
a way,
right.
because you'd see what, you know, what human beings are capable of. And even if it is history, there was something that seems so terrifyingly futuristic about it. That mashing of genres, you know, worked as a kind of warning bell to me.
But that's what is so perverse about sort of a government reaching out to a science fiction writer and saying, yeah, this is how we could, you know, use this basically for a corporate good to come up with new ideas, where it's like there has creeped into our sort of cultural DNA, I think, an unthinking excitement about new goods.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, here's the new goggles that I can use to God knows what, like watch porn all day. I'm sorry, but I know there are better uses for this, but it just seems to me very dystopian.
No, it's unreal how stupid and unnecessary it seems.
And but
right
but,
now.
But we say yes, 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 yes to it, thinking that, of course, new technologies, new discoveries will lead to better human outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, science fiction, if it is civically useful, to use your term, Alex, it is to put out implicitly or explicitly a warning to say not every discovery is a net benefit. Things can be good and things can be bad. Guess what? The struggle session was a technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so was the whipping post. The witch trial was a technology, right? Like, and so it is to me alarming that, you know, the people that are bringing new things into our lives accept uncritically the logic of technological advancement.
Well, this is interesting. This is bringing me back to my metaphor of the parabola, which I used before for Nomi's own hero's journey towards sci-fi, away from sci-fi, now perhaps back to sci-fi.
Listen, I am more open than I was,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit, and I'd like to hear your guys, you know, kind of closing thoughts on this, but I don't know if science fiction is the new realism. I think there's definitely a case to be made that it is, and there's mm-hmm. also a case to be made that, you know, realism is still realism. Maybe they're two sides of the same coin. But I think in some ways we are all in the position of science fiction characters, just in that, like, stuff is hitting us all the time. New realities are hitting us all the time. Like, you may want to close your eyes to AI. You may want to close your eyes to climate change, which we, let's be clear, do not. AI, yeah, sure, I'd like to just like shut mm-hmm. my eyes and have that not be a thing, but it's a thing. And so we are now all, if not Paul Atreides, who I don't identify with at all, then maybe I identify with someone who's just like, wait, I was having a great time on my home planet, and now you're telling me the whole House of Atreides has to move to Arrakis? Like, I'd rather not. But yeah, we may all be that person in the back who's loaded up onto the airship and sent away.
That's right.
So science fiction may not be the new realism, but it is the new reality. Maybe that's where
Definitely.
I'm
Definitely. And I think it's a continuation of the way reality has been for a lot of people. It's just that we in America have been protected from the kind of vicissitudes of history. I mean, America has undergone many evolutions and revolutions, but on the whole, this is a country that has been immensely lucky in being protected from rollicking movements of history. And now with these kind of future, sudden futurity being thrust upon us, I think it's true that we are kind of finding ourselves in a position of being protagonists in this new drama where it's like, what do you mean? Wait a minute. There might be some discomfort or some fear coming my way. You know, like, what do you mean there might be no water? What do you mean we might, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that is incredibly frightening. And that's a new realization for a lot of us.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I totally love this idea. But I think that it makes us all, even as we are protagonists in a kind of drama, it also makes us have to perform the creative work of the science fiction writer. The classic science fiction question is the counterfactual question of, like, what if? And so every new reality causes us to react, not just in a sort of intuitive way, but in a creative way.
Mm.
What if I live my life as if? You change, you reposition, you sort of reimagine possibilities around a new reality. This is one of the like, constant drudgeries of modern life, it seems to me, that even though there is an excitement to it, it's like every day I need to come up with a new counterfactual way to live my life.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that shit makes me tired.
Oh, so tired.
I just want to live.
So tired. I know, exactly.
How I have.
Exactly.
But, you know, yeah. But that may not be the privilege that is accorded to you or
I think
any
that's
of us.
Right, yeah.
Well, I just want to say that if there are any listeners out there who live on a planet that is not Earth, please contact us at themail@newyorker.com because we have yet to set up the satellite that will allow you to ping us directly. Or else, just insert yourself directly into our brains. We're ready for you. This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us, please, at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line critics. See you next Thursday.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.